So this is this started as a project for this master student for his final year, and until we found a paper by Carlo Rovelli called "What is a Particle?", we were sort of lost. We were trying to do this, to do this, but the whole concept was to try to understand localization in quantum field theory. So this talk is about an elaboration and further development of an idea by Rovelli, and also putting it inside a mathematical framework that is developed by mathematicians, and which you also find in Ward's book. And this framework is how you quantize a free field, and sort of see what kind of assumptions you actually need to find a Fock-space representation. This is the boss, Juan León. And I'm at his research group in Madrid, Physique. Marco de Reis is a PhD student there. And also we have a visitor here from IQC, Eric Brown. And we're continuing this kind of research and trying to find some kind of experiments to detect local quanta. Anyway, that's enough of an introduction, I guess. So we're going to start. So the whole topic is about localization, huh, in quantum field theory. So first, we're going to run through a few points or a few results and theorems that pose problems for the notion of a localized particle in quantum field theory. There's problems with the Newton-Wigner position operator, something called the Hegerfeld paradox, and the apparent superluminal propagation of wave packets. There's theorem by Knight showing that it's impossible to have strictly localized states. Then there's further elaborations in terms of localization systems by Malament, Busch, and Clifton, and Halvorsen, and so on. Next, we're gonna, in order to develop sort of Rovelli's idea, we're gonna introduce this mathematical machinery, which is basically taken from Ward's book, but made available for physicists because it's a bit inaccessible to what he does in his book. So we have put in that kind of language, this kind of mathematics, but in terms of very simple things like mode expansions and so on. And then, but making sure that we have sort of also contact with sort of the mathematical side. Then we're going to show how you can define basically, these theorems up here, they are abstract theorems. They're not constructive approaches to try to define local quanta. They just state you can't do it. So the idea here of this talk is to try to just construct these things. What happens when you do it? So we're going to do different kinds of quantization scheme based on Ward's sort of procedure. And this is based on non-stationary modes, not the usual ones you would use in quantum field theory. And in the end, we're going to sort of find the culprit, what happens when you try to construct this local quanta. This local Fock-space representation turns out to be unitarily inequivalent. So as soon as you try to have local quanta in field theory, you have a Fock-space which is not unitarily equivalent to the ordinary Fock-space. Anyway, we're going to talk if this is a, we're going to mention it or discuss if this is a problem or not for quantum field theory and from this construction. In any case, you can use the tools you gather from doing a local quantization. Those tools you can use to study local properties of the global vacuum or the ordinary vacuum in quantum field theory. So you can look at, you can numerically quantify vacuum entanglement. You can look at the Rich-Lieder theorem. You can look at the spectrum of local particles, which you would think is well, in the ordinary vacuum state, which you would think is empty. But it's not empty if you look at local particles. So I have to apologize if there's some errors on the slides. There's Murphy's Law for seminar givers. No matter how hard you try, the last slides are always written just before the talk. So anyway, So here is Hegerfeld's paradox. A one particle state in quantum field theory is taken to be a, well, it's described by a positive frequency or a superposition of positive frequency modes. And if you consider a scalar field, that state have to satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation. But since you're restricting yourself to positive frequencies, you can also take the square root of this equation. So now, let me try to draw something. If you, for example, consider a wave packet, which is originally localized within the region R here, and outside it's exactly zero, because you have restricted yourself to positive frequencies, you can show that after an infinitesimal time duration, or, you'll find this state phi plus everywhere in space. So that looks like a blatant contradiction with causality. So of course, when we write down a wave packet like this, it's very tempting to think of this wave packet as describing something which is localized in space. So it looks like a paradox, and this you can call this the Hegerfeld paradox. And also, this is very, very puzzling because we started from the Klein-Gordon equation, which is sort of the poster boy for causal relativistic wave equations, right? So how could that possibly happen, right? How could we violate sort of, I mean, how could we get something superluminal? And of course, there's nothing superluminal going on here. So basically, the Hegerfeld discovered this in the 70s sometime. And it's, and then he generalized his theorem and so on, took away assumptions. And so I'm referring to one of his earlier sort of theorems here. Anyway, so from the perspective of the Klein-Gordon equation, there's nothing superluminal going on here. This is a second order partial differential equation. And that second order is important here because when we look at the pictures like this, we get our intuitions from the Schrödinger equation usually when we think about quantum mechanics, and that's a first order equation. But in order to provide initial data for this one here, you need to provide both initial configuration and velocity. And so here's the culprit. If you look at only positive frequency solutions, then you can show that it's not possible for both phi plus and phi plus dot, the time derivative, to be zero at the same time, except for a measure zero set of points. So there's nothing superluminal going on here. It's just that when you say that this is well localized here, phi dot out here is non-zero. And that's the resolution of the paradox. And there's nothing more to it than that. There's nothing strange, a causal going on in the wave propagation. You just have non-local initial conditions. But then it also tells you that this picture there, that if you have some kind of packet which is localized in space, it tells you that the interpretation of that state is wrong. You cannot think of this as some kind of localized entity in space. It's somehow non-local. One may try to, well, may hope that this paradox will go away if you look at the Newton-Wigner position operator. But that thing has, if you consider a position eigenstate, you can show it has the same kind of property that just a bit after, you can find it anywhere in space. So the only conclusion here seems to be that don't think that you're looking at something which is localized in space, because if you do so, you have problems with causality. So it's only when you have sort of a particle interpretation that this is a problem. To further compound this kind of problem, there's Knight in 61 who introduced the notion of strict localization, which is a really, it's not, there's nothing strict about it. It's a very natural notion of localization. you consider a one-particle state. You can also consider an n-particle state. And then you require that you say that such a state would be localized, strictly localized, within the spatial region R at some time t, if you take an operator spatially separated to it. So you may think of it, you have some spatial region here, R, and you require it if you take an operator here, O and x and t, which is space-like to this region, then the expectation value for any operator you may choose, the expectation value should coincide with that of the vacuum. You should not be able to tell if the state there or not. You just find the same kind of expectation value as if it were the vacuum. And then it's because of analytic properties and so on, you can go on and show that you cannot have strictly localized n particle states. They will always have some expectation value which is not that of the vacuum. So again, you see that particles in quantum field theory are not really localized objects. They are everywhere.
Maybe you can do it both ways. I mean, some people have said that maybe we need to revise the concept of particle. Here, when you say particle, you're talking about the thought world.
Yes.
Or some mathematical definition.
Yes.
But this mathematical definition has nothing to do with what happens when the data appear.
Yes, right. Exactly.
So
this is, yeah, this is the talk,
so
basically.
There's this big debate in the literature whether the particle or this abstract or the things you see in the data.
Exactly. So, well, on that note, precisely that, right? So you can view it in two distinct ways. Suppose you have a detector here now, and now we just established that a Fock space particle, an ordinary one, is everywhere in space. If you have a detector here, which is localized in space, it can hardly be that this detector detects such a quanta, because then it would absorb. So in particular, the energy density is also spread out non-local in space. If that were the case, then the energy density must also be swooped up here in an instant, and that doesn't make sense. So number two, you can also think of just an hydrogen atom. You have an atom here, and this is the ground state, and it's in its excited state. And then it falls down, and it sends out a quanta. What is that thing now? Is it a single Fock space quanta now, or maybe two of them, or superposition of? And it's sort of clear here that, I mean, how could it be a single particle coming out, or two particles? The atom is localized, presumably, and then it would create a state which is everywhere in space. So thank you for the question. It's exactly this kind of thinking or heuristics that goes into here, that maybe we need to refine our notion of particle. So, and this is also in Rovelli's paper, What is a Particle? He has this, he has
a
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So but this tension, you know, which has been resolved, when you put back gravity, then you have to go back. What do we really mean by particle?
I'm not gonna spend too much on this slide. This is people have looked at this kind of questions in different kind of mathematical language in terms of localization systems. Here important names are Malament, Bush, Clifton, Halvorsen, and so on, and they have done generalizations of theorems and so on, considered POVMs instead of strict position measurements and so on, and you can show that within quantum field theory, within sort of natural assumptions, you cannot really have localized systems. So, and those are very important. That these are sort of abstract theorems, not constructive, but they're very important in telling you that some of these, if you want to have a notion of local quanta or local particles, one of these assumptions must go. Then, of course, when we combine things with gravity, there's more challenge to the notion of a particle, because the ordinary notion of a Fock quanta or a particle in quantum field theory is based on symmetries of the Minkowski spacetime. And then, of course, you go to a curved spacetime, or even you just put in a time-dependent external field in your theory. You see that this construction breaks down. You see that there's no preferred way of talking about one, two particles, or zero particles, and so on. So there's an ambiguity in what you mean by particle number and a single particle, and so on. Yeah. So here's Wald so this comes back to these different points of view people have. So is this really a problem for quantum field theory, that you have a particle number ambiguity? You cannot really decide if it's five particles or superposition of 1,000 and 3,000 particles or whatever. So in his book, Quantum Field Theory in Curved Spacetimes, and we very much follow his sort of mathematical procedure later on. He writes, indeed, I view the lack of an algorithm for defining a preferred notion of particles in curved spacetime to be closely analogous to the lack of an algorithm for defining a preferred system of coordinates in classical general relativity. And then he says that he is familiar only with presentations of special relativity based on the use of global coordinates might well find this fact to be alarming. In both cases, the lack of an algorithm does not by itself pose any difficulty for the formulation of the theory. So here he's pointing to that even though if you don't have access to positive and negative frequency modes or Poincaré symmetry and so on, you can still provide a Fock space representation and so on. And this is exactly what we're going to exploit, but not in the curved spacetime, but in a super simple example of a one-dimensional box. So back in my mind when I talk, we're only going to talk about a particle in a box here. And so it's we have boundary conditions here, Dirichlet ones. So that's the setup. And then we're going to try to define a set of local particles, which might be localized in this region or that region. But anyway, the Klein-Gordon equation is a linear equation. So mathematically, you realize that the solution space is a vector space, because if you take two members of the solution space, you can add them up with two real numbers and get another solution. We're dealing with a real classical field here, but it will be important when we come to the quantum level, where you will the complex valued solutions of these guys will pop up naturally. So this is just an extension. We just think of complex valued solutions to these equations, and that's it. So solutions form a vector space. We shall think of these solutions as vectors, sort of, and provide later also a Dirac-Ket notation. The next important concept is that of the Klein-Gordon inner product, which is this one up there. It satisfies the usual things here. This is an extra thing which comes about because, it's a specific property of this inner product. But it's not positive definite. So the vector space of solutions doesn't form a Hilbert space. And here's an important fact also. If you have two fields and they satisfy the same Klein-Gordon equation with the same boundary conditions, then this inner product is time independent. You note here that this is just integration over x and not t. So importantly, it's a time independent complex number you can calculate. Now, the Klein-Gordon inner product partitions the complex solution space into three subspaces, those with positive norm, negative norm, and zero norm. The real valued solutions are in this one. So they're always, you can think of it in terms of a light cone. The positive ones, vectors lie here. They have positive norm. Then you have ones with negative norm. Then you have zero norms. And these are the real fields. So, and if you take complex conjugation, you go from here to here. It's important that neither of these subsets, I shouldn't call them subspaces, I should call them subsets. None of them are vector spaces. And that's sort of, it's clear. If you take two positive norm states, these two guys, these are both positive norm, you can subtract them and get this guy. So it's not closed under addition, so it's not a vector space. In order to progress, we introduce a complete set of orthonormal solutions. We have to find this set. And in the simple systems, of course, it's easy to do this by separation of variables and so on. By orthonormal, we mean this, that when we compute the Klein-Gödel inner product, this is the Kronecker delta, these have negative norms, so you have to have a minus sign there. And with the complex conjugation, you go from positive to negative, so they're orthonormal ones. By complete, we mean that any solution can be built as an expansion. So the expansion coefficients will just be the Klein-Gödel inner products, like this. And any solution can be built like this. The minus sign, again, is here because you have negative norm states. Yeah. You can further massage this completeness relation. And in fact, you get two distinct relations from it by if you just work things out. This is the thing that plays a key role in the Fock space quantization and finding creation and annihilation operators. So we're going to provide a bit of Dirac notation. Solutions, we just call a ket vector. We use round brackets here because we're going to use pointy ones, the ordinary ones, for states in the quantum field, for the quantum field. You can also define sort of the bra vector, because you have an inner product, and you can just look at the dual. The completeness relation here takes a really simple form, again with this minus sign, because of these are negative norm states or solutions. Once we have introduced sort of these modes, we have imposed extra structure. For example, you can look now at this space, when you have the span of just the positive norm states here, or the positive norm modes, these have all positive Klein-Gödel norm by construction. And in addition, they form a vector space. So remember the argument here that if you take two of these guys, you can take the difference. But let me add an extra dimension here. And this is sort of the light cone here. If you now restrict yourself to only look at vectors in this plane here, no component in that direction at all, it's impossible to get a negative norm state. So if you just look at this space here, that is a vector space. And number two, it's also a Hilbert space, because the Klein-Gödel inner product, when restricted to that subspace, is positive definite. So that space is later going to turn out to be the one particle Hilbert space. In Wald's book, you're going to find this complex structure appearing. In our mode decompositions, it just looks like that. It's just something very concrete here. Now, let's proceed to quantization. Now you need to find sort of a representation of the equal time commutation relations. So a normal one, or sort of naive attempt, is just to do this, right? But then you end up with a state which is a functional, and you get that, you end up with uncountably infinite number of degrees of freedom. It's very hard to work with that mathematically. To lessen this problem, to get something easy to work with, we do this mode expansion. You take our field now, and you expand it in this mode expansion. So then you can see that if this condition here is satisfied, which comes from the completeness relation. You just work your way out. You plug sort of your expansion in here. You can see that if you impose those, you get the representation of these canonical commutation relations. Then you can do the usual stuff, define the vacuum like that, the Fock space, by repeated applications of the creation operators. And then here we can also see that, that the whole Fock space becomes sort of a structure like this, where this one particle Hilbert space, which we saw before, figures everywhere, but symmetrized because it's the bosonic one. So the usual way of doing it, to put in a bit more concretely, I haven't said anything about the modes now. I just said I had some kind of complete and orthonormal set of modes. And so let's do something specific. Usually, if you have a system like that, you have a one-dimensional Klein-Gordon field, or a Klein-Gordon field in the one-dimensional box. The modes would look like this. And you have positive and negative frequencies related by complex conjugation like this. And then you would just do the same expansion here, and you do the same construction, blah, 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 right? Of course, the Hamiltonian has an infinite quantity, which you need to subtract. Of course, this is just one set of modes you can have. You can choose now. What if you chose something different? This is going to be important for us, right? Because we don't want to do what everybody else has been doing, because then we get stuck with there are no local quanta and so on. If you do that, if you introduce a second set of modes, then you find that you should be able to expand the field in two distinct ways. And then by just saying that that field here is the same as that field there, and by making use of the Klein-Gordon inner product and the orthogonality relations and so on, you find that you can relate these guys by Bogoliubov transformations. Usually these coefficients here are called alphas and betas. Here I'm preferring to be more explicit what they are. They're just Klein-Gordon inner products. That's what they are. So of course this is also the particle number ambiguity here. If this coefficient here is non-zero, you find that this guy doesn't kill the ordinary vacuum anymore. So it's not clear how to what you should mean by the vacuum. So let me also say another thing here. I have not mentioned anything about positive or negative frequency. It hasn't appeared at all. So that will be important. None of that is important in this construction. The only key point was positive norm and negative norm states, not positive frequency or negative frequency. So when we're dealing with infinitely many degrees of freedom, as in the case for a quantum field, you can have unitary inequivalent representations. And here we're going to show that local quanta lead to unitary inequivalent representations. So we'll have to have a way of proving that. And one way to do it is to show that the number operator with respect to one set of, with respect to one quantization, the expectation value of that in terms of the other vacuum defined by the other Fock space is infinite. So this is, for example, what happened in the Rindler quantization. If you look at the number of Minkowski particles in the Rindler vacuum, it's infinite, and vice versa. There you have a case of unitary inequivalence, for example. Yeah. So, for example, you find this as a sufficient condition in Wald's book, for example. But the idea is the following, right? That you have a Foxbase representation and a collection of relevant operators you're working with. And then two representations are unitary equivalent if there's a unitary map from one to the other, so that the expectation values are preserved. So the operators in one representation, the operators in another representation, you take the expectation values here, you make the unitary transformation, and you're supposed to get the same answer. So.
Well, I guess maybe the, so you have an index M on your N. Do you mean just the occupation number of the nth node? And that should be finite in any actual state?
I'm going to get to exactly this. This is what happened in Rindler quantization. These are the beta square coefficients. So, for example, when they show unitary inequivalence there, they look at this quantity trace beta dagger beta, and they show that this is infinite. So that's, I mean.
I think you're confusing or conflating two things, because if M is fixed, the mode you're talking about, then in the Rindler case, there's no infinity.
Yeah, so you need to sum over all of it, both N and M. Is that your point?
Any given
mode is okay. Yes. Well, there's an asymmetry. We're going to get exactly to that. There's also an asymmetry.
But sometimes it's still not at all clear to me why this is required by unitary equivalence, that this sum over all modes of N and M remains
fine. To me, so they define unitary equivalence as you have a Foxbase representation and a set of relevant physical operators, and then a different one, and then they want to have a unitary map. And then I haven't looked at the proof, but this is that's a sufficient condition for establishing unitary inequivalence.
Right. So, but why I was asking about is the proof. Yes. Why
I shouldn't. Yeah. Okay. So I won't be. Yes, so they did.
So, what the sum over all possible particle states is?
The sum over N of NM is a finite integration. The total number of particles is.
Why should it be? It's not like I could have one, two. I could have infinitely many particles. I could have as many particles as I like.
Yes.
I create 27 gajillion particles.
Yes,
if I
but.
Want.
Yeah.
No, but that's how you define the question.
But they're already not.
You take it as a completion.
Yeah, so I think what Laurent is referring
to.
What
you're saying is if I cut it off in one, it might be infinite in the other.
Let me add something to this. You have the vacuum, or you can have sort of, this would be the different mode occupations now, and then the rest is zero. That would be an element, that would be a vector in the Fox space. Suppose now you look at the state. That's not in the Fox space. And in fact, one way of generating, this is called the Myriop. You know the name, right? Myriop. You can generate sort of unitary inequivalent representations by adding on to this guy an infinite number of particles. And then from that state, just denote it and call it the vacuum. And then you add on sort of more and more particles to that state. So it's sort of like this. You're not allowing. I mean, one of the reasons here is that you want to have your basis to be countably infinite, the dimension of the Hilbert space countably infinite, right? If you allow these things here.
So if I annihilate it, I'll still have the same thing because I got infinite on the end ones, and I can just push them over. Is that the end?
Yeah. So here, if. Exactly, by finite operations, exactly, right? So this, if you allow states like this, right, you have an uncountably infinite Hilbert space.
But what troubles me is that sum over M is presumably going to arbitrarily large M, right? So it's going from zero to infinity, so effectively it is going to be that. That's what's confusing.
So
there's no cutoff in that first sum.
No, but the cutoff is in the state by definition of Fox state. state which has only a finite number of non-zero entries.
But as large a finite as I feel.
Yeah, but in any state, it's still finite. I mean, in some sense, the uncomfortableness here comes from that. It's really a mathematical thing. The universe is a finite universe, but all these things go away. It's really,
well,
it really comes from deep here.
I guess what's confusing me, maybe Ted too, is it seems to me the initial definition of what it is just as confusing as what one is trying to show.
Well, actually, Ted's discussion clarified it for me because I sort of had forgotten that, or maybe never sufficiently appreciated that in defining Fock space, you really restrict to states which have zero excitation beyond some point, any point. It can be arbitrarily.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's
a potential infinite, right? Potential infinite.
Any given state you get from that state, anyone, has to be zero after some.
Well, sure.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm summing over all of them. This is what's possible.
So he's not summing over states, he's summing over modes.
Exactly, yeah.
In the label, the different
states. And also, yeah.
If you're alone in finite superposition, but it's really a mathematical.
So anyway, this is also a bit my fault because I've actually never bothered to go through the proof of it. But it is along these lines.
I mean, the proof more is like the definition.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no problem. Once you define the first state,
then
you're done.
And also, if you...
But then the question is, why is the definition of physics that's part of your
Anyway, in philosophy, you like to talk about these things, right? So it's all good, right? Do you have anything to add, or
no?
No. So first, now, when we proceed here, just like to stress again here, the central concept we have been using is that of positive or negative norm, not that of positive and negative frequency. So if you take the usual modes we had for the ordinary standard quantization, what I call the global quantization, it's true that these guys have positive norm and this guy has negative norm. So in that case, the notions of positive frequency and positive norm, they coincide. But now, if we, for example, have some kind of external field around, or if we have curved space-time, time-dependent, and so on. It's not clear what you mean by positive frequency. You don't have stationary states and so on. But the concept of positive norm and negative norm is always well-defined. And that's sort of the key point here, that what goes into quantization, if you're just interested in getting a Fock space representation of the canonical commutation relations, what goes into that is the positive norm and not the positive frequency. Yeah. So then, we have to ask now, because in quantum field theory books, especially in algebraic quantum field theory, they restrict themselves to always have the one particle Hilbert space have to be made out of positive frequency states. That's one of the axioms. Find that in the Hogg-Kastler axioms and the Weitmann axioms and so on. But we saw that if we stick to that, then no one particle state or even n particle state can be localized. And if we trace back to this, what we had discussed before here, right? The reason they cannot be localized is exactly because we're restricting ourselves to positive frequencies. So is it absolutely necessary to have the one particle Hilbert space generated or spanned by positive frequency modes? Now, is that absolutely necessary? No, of course, necessary for what? I mean, if we go back to what I just did here, it's not necessary if you're only interested in finding a Fock space representation. So nothing here depends on stationary modes of positive or negative frequency. And this is very much what I'm doing here, is very much following Wald was it what he's doing in his book.
So you're perfectly right. You have to mention that you need the reason why people focus on this notion of particle, which is not the right. None of these particles our particles would be taking the pictures. But it comes from a guy in Bali.
Yeah.
So this is theory that says that, you know, any normal notion of particles are now defined the notion of bacteria, which really not depend on.
So
I think you should know where you're going, but that's the big
thing. Yeah, that's the big thing, yes. And of course, the problematic thing there is that notion doesn't generalize to curved space-time with time dependence and so on, right? Oh, so Rovelli in this paper, What is a Particle? He suggested to look at, instead of these kind of modes, and here is just one mode here, you can also consider the other modes. Instead of looking at these global stationary modes now, we partition this one into two sections. This point we call little r here. And then you build up small modes here. And from Fourier analysis, if you provide sort of these small sinus modes here and these small sinus modes here, you can in fact build up any mode for the full. I shouldn't call them modes here because these are not solutions. This is without time. So that, there's no solution space and so on. So this is just Fourier analysis. If you want something that looks like this, you can always build it from local stuff. Of course, you're going to get some kind of Gibbs ripple phenomena here and so on, right? But you have convergence. In fact, you have pointwise convergence, except for a zero measure zero set of points and so on. It's proved by a Swedish guy, by the way, Carlsson. So, for example, if I go to the next slide, I'm going to expand on that a bit. One of the issues here is that, which is not developed in Rovelli's paper, how do you think about this point here? Should you, because now this is at an instant now, should you think of this point here as you impose a Dirichlet boundary condition which holds for all times now? Well, that's strange, right? Because if you inserting a boundary there, it's like putting in a mirror there, which is exactly what Eric Brown is working on, in fact, right now. And then you change the physical system. So you say, I want to define local quanta. By the way, I'm going to consider a different system. That doesn't make sense, right? So one has to really think about what that means. In mathematical terms, when you put in the Dirichlet boundary condition there, your solutions satisfying that new boundary condition are not going to be in the old solution space. So it's not clear what's going to happen. So what's the way out of here? Well, if you have a free particle, why would you presume it would be localized for all times? The way out here is that, say that, oh, it's just localized for a single moment in time, right? So, and now expanding on what you're saying here, we're going to look at the mode which is initially localized within here. So this is a positive norm state. This is a theta function, which makes it completely zero here. And it's a sinus one, so it's one of those. And then we're going to have these guys here defined on the other side. We also have to provide initial data. Or the time derivatives here also to define the modes. Otherwise, we don't know how they will propagate in time. Also here, both this guy and that guy is zero outside here. So that means you cannot build such modes without negative frequencies. So that's where sort of this issue comes in with that you have to start using negative frequencies. And people are going to say, oh, you're going to get problems with negative energy and Hamiltonian is not bounded from below and so on. And that's actually false. And I'm gonna comment on that later. So you get the idea now. Instead of having the stationary modes which just sit there and all the time dependence confined to a phase, we're gonna start with a mode here, which when you let it go, it's gonna spread out inside of the full of the box. This looks like really messy modes. I mean, how would you work with these kind of non-stationary modes?
And so at that point, R then is not a physical barrier. It's just
no, exactly. Exactly. So this is in our mind. We would like to look at localized particles, and they localize a specific time, and we say, oh, I want to look at particles localized in this region. There's nothing there, right? Now, in order to make any sense of these modes, we have to solve the Cauchy problem to know how they look like at all times. But this is trivial because we've all made or defined things in terms of vectors and the Dirac notation. So this mode here, remember the Dirac notation here? This is this local mode. Well, here we just insert the identity, and then you just work it out, and you see you get something like that. And you can rewrite that in an ordinary notation. So the only thing you need to do here to know the time evolution of this guy is just to work out the Bogoliubov coefficients, because these are the ordinary stationary global modes you had before, and you know their time evolution, which is just in a phase. So here you can just calculate these things. There's a mistake in the paper we have on the archive. There's a minus sign here, a pesky minus sign we forgot. So that leads to a difference in one plot, which is the correlation plot. I'm going to show it later. You had a question? Here. So one important thing here is also that since we didn't put in a boundary here, we just said, look, these are free modes. We know that they satisfy the same equations of motion, the same Klein-Gordon equation, with the same boundary conditions. It's just literally a boundary here. That means that the Klein-Gordon inner product is time-independent. That just gives a time-independent complex number. So you can calculate it at any moment in time now. You can choose to try to calculate that at some later time, and it's, you know, it's very difficult, right? Or you may try to calculate at time equals zero when the modes look like that. And of course, that's the time you're going to calculate them in. Of course, the t equals zero is just some choice here. You can put any time you like. You can choose them. Here? Study which ones? I'm not going to comment any. Yeah, you can get some funny numerical issues coming there.
When is it a good approximation? So let's say one question is, when is it a good approximation between the real particle in the box is like a fog particle?
I'm going to give a plot. So here's how they look like if you have computed everything, and these are the news I had on the previous slide. And here you can see manifestly that they propagate in a locally causal way. So they don't have this Hegerfeld paradox kind of superluminal propagation quality to them. And that has to do with that we put both phi and phi dot zero outside the region of localization. This is not something you can do with positive frequencies alone. So that's the key difference that comes in here. Here's quantization. How would you expand your field? You have all these modes. There's modes to the left, modes to the right, and there's positive and negative norm modes. And so this is the complete expansion. Of course, you can also expand this field in terms of the ordinary stationary modes, the global modes, as we call them. And then you can find this Bogoliubov coefficient or relations between the craters, the local craters and annihilators. And you can also show that this set of modes is a complete and orthonormal set of solutions also. And that's important, of course. Then you build your Fock space like this. Go back a slide.
Where is the combination of the mode between left guy and right guy?
Yeah, that's zero. So that turns out, and that has to do with that the.
So AN, and we're just, you know, we're going to does it carry a neighbor that says it's left alone?
Oh, yeah. So sorry, I haven't said that. That's bad. Bars is on the right, and without bars is on the left. So sorry about that. Yeah, of course. Yeah, exactly. And they all, I mean, because of microcausality, you also should have that, right? All the new modes, the local modes?
Right.
Yeah, so they are made to vanish there per definition because you say that they look like this. So they're sinus modes.
That seems like it's somehow not complete.
So there's a theorem in Fourier analysis that that inside here, from these modes, you can build any function you like. Of course, you're going to have to use a lot of high frequencies to get it to go up here, all the way up. But they're all zero there. So the statement is the following, that you have pointwise convergence for almost all points. But of course, exactly that point, the pointwise convergence is going to fail,
yeah.
Right? And you're probably going to have maybe some kind of ripple effect there, or you know, Gibbs ripple, and so on. But let me.
If I expand the field operator in these modes,
mm-hmm.
then the field operator is zero operator, like at that point.
Exactly.
So then, in any state, if it made sense to evaluate.
So these are yeah. So it's important also that you one think about operators as operator value distributions. Yep.
And does that smearing take care of exactly this point?
There's a lot of mathematical questions. We spoke to a mathematician in Madrid, and after an afternoon, he didn't think there was any problems with his construction. But also, but so there's a lot of concerns one can have. But the thing is that if you take these modes here, you have a very powerful theorem from Fourier analysis. This is Carlisson's, and it was proven in the 60s that you get pointwise convergence for almost all points, and I think that's enough. I'm not because in field theory the operators are they have to be smeared and so on. I don't see how this could make a difference, right? So, but I'm not a mathematician. I think this will make sense. That's. I haven't thought about that. In fact, one thing we did think about was instead of Dirichlet boundary conditions, what happens if you have von Neumann boundary conditions? And the mathematician we talked to said that no, I think you're going to have real problems with that case if you have Neumann boundary conditions, and you would get something which didn't work mathematically. So it had to be this. But I can't comment too closely on these things. So let me go to the important thing here is that you build your Fock space like this. The left and the right creation operators, they commute. So the Fock space, the local Fock space, which is a tensor product between the one on the left and the one on the right. So that doesn't happen in the usual vacuum or the usual Fock space, the global one or the standard one. Doesn't have that structure of being a tensor product between one region and another region. So that's something new that happens here. Yeah. Here we have made use of negative energies. This might be alarming, blah blah blah. But this, if you follow things through here, you see that this is just a problem for relativistic quantum mechanics. And that's people are worried about this for historical reasons. But at the level of a field, what you're starting with is always manifestly positive. This is at the classical level. And when you quantize this thing, it's also manifestly positive. And we, in the paper, we show explicitly that you always get manifestly positive energies and so on. And that goes both for the local quantization and also when you apply local operators on the global quantization, there's no problem with energy. You have to do a regularization though. You have to subtract it, right? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So here, this is the proof of unitarian equivalence. You just do integral test of convergence and you see it immediately. There's a difference here, and that sounds related to a point raised before. If you sum over m only, you get infinite. But if you sum over n and not m, you get something finite. There's an asymmetry coming to play here. So that means that the global or the standard number operators are ill-defined on the local vacuum. And in continuation, also in all the local Fock states. That gives you infinite. They're just bad operators. But interestingly enough, the opposite isn't true. Well, if you take these local number operators on the global vacuum, you get something which is infinite. The two? Where? Yeah, so they're all infinite. And they're all... Yeah, I'm just saying they're both infinite. That's it. Anyway, I should continue to the plots. Let's pick up on that later. You can see the nice plots here. Take some time for this. Yeah. Anyway, you can plot this quantity, the local number, the expectation value of the local number operator in the global vacuum. And then you see this thermal-looking bath. So this is when you have your box here, and then you're confining yourself to this part here, and you're saying, how many local particles are here? And you see that it's full of activity in the global vacuum, if you analyze it locally, and that comes back to your detector question, right? I mean, locally, shouldn't we see something like this in the vacuum, right? This looks thermal, naively speaking, but it cannot be thermal because if you sum up this distribution, it has to be infinite because of unitarian equivalence. And here comes these peaks. They will never really die off fast enough, so you get the finite answer. So that's the unitarian equivalence. So these are not thermal distributions. Is unitarian equivalence a problem? Well, this is up to debate, right? We have one in the philosophy community here who has been going at it, right? What we see from the previous plot is that you get a lot of high energy particles or high energy modes around. Suppose now you put in a real physical detector, some realistic detector, right? That's not going to be sensitive to really, really high energetic modes. So there's going to be a natural cutoff. So all that infinity there is not going to be felt by a physical device. So there's a general question here. Is this unitarian equivalence really a problem? And if you want to say, it's a problem for physics, you should try to pose some operational question. I have this detector and I model it in this way, and I think it's a realistic one, or blah, 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 right? Does it give you bad answers now? And it seems to me that as soon as you do something which is physically realistic, you're going to have this natural cutoff put in there. You're always going to get finite answers, even though you have a detector. Here, and there are all this infinite amount of energy floating around, it's not going to be sensible to it. If it's high frequency enough or high energy enough, it just passes through transparently, like it was, So Wald, for example, and many others take the view that this is not the problem for physics. You just have to, any real measurements you do, there's a natural cutoff associated with that, and that's about it. There might be an issue in general relativity because curvature is sensitive to absolute energy. So now you can also look at vacuum entanglement. You ask the particles here and the particles there, the local ones, are they correlated or are they entangled? Then you can look at the correlation coefficients, and they look something like this. In the paper, you're going to find the wrong plot because there's a pesky minus sign we didn't get. But this is the way they look at. This is a more boring plot than we have in the paper. The wrong one made more sense to us. Or rather, it made more sense to us when we tried to explain it. Anyway, you can also have sort of a neat little example of the Riesz-Leder theorem here, or quantum steering using this kind of entanglement. So you imagine you do a local operation on one side. Can you change the state on the other side? And of course, the important here is that you will do a local but non-unitary operation on the state. It's always important that it's non-unitary, otherwise nothing interesting happens. Anyway, so you imagine that you just hit this guy by a local creator. So you do something local here, right? Can I see that immediately on the other side? And then if you compute the difference in the expectation value of this state here and the vacuum, you see that it's exactly proportional to the correlation coefficients. So because of vacuum entanglement, you do something here, you get an immediate effect on the other side. But of course, this is a non-unitary operation, and such an operation has to be implemented by post-selection and so on, and that will involve signaling. So there's no problem with local causality. Anyway, so. No, it's not correlated, exactly. Yeah. So for example, let me go back to a slide. I don't have too much time. So here, if you would choose, this is the correlation coefficients, and you calculate it in this way with psi here. If you put this guy here, you see that this guy here is exactly zero. So in the local vacuum, you have no correlations. In the global vacuum, that's where you have all the correlations and all the entanglement. Because the local vacuum is a product state. It's deliberately constructed like that. And also, it's not a stationary state either. So I put the bar here. This would be the local vacuum. If you evolve this state, you find that it changes.
Right. So, yeah. At time zero.
Exactly. So this is just a state. Yeah, or you can evolve the operators in whatever picture you like, right? So, do you want to recap on what we just did, or? Well, so basically, we by brute force we try to construct local quanta. And the starting point was this paper by Rovelli. And when we sort of couched this in the framework of Wald's book, what he's doing there with this quantization procedure, we find that this local quantization leads to a Fock space which is unitary and equivalent. Of course, there's a lot of debate what that actually means and if it has any implications for physics or not, and for gravity, maybe, and so on. But the interesting thing is that regardless if it's a unitary and equivalent or not, you got a set of toolbox or a set of operators where you can use to analyze the global vacuum, which most people don't have an issue with. There's no problems of negative energies. So this scare people have that, oh, I'm using negative frequencies, I'm going to get problems with negative energies. That doesn't happen at the quantum field theory level. The Hamiltonian is always bounded from below. After suitable regularization, you take normal ordering or you subtract the infinite energy of the vacuum, the corresponding vacuum. Then, so this is an ongoing research here. What about these local particles? Can you actually detect those? Maybe you can detect it in the lab, right? So with Eric Brown, this is your student, right? Yeah. And also with Andre Dragan, we had some conversations to make a proposal how you can sort of implement this in the lab and try really to see this almost thermal bath of particles. And so Eric Brown had this idea that you have this global vacuum state, and then you slam a mirror down. That has to be implemented somehow in the lab. And then after, you're going to look for these local particles there. Anyway, there's also, I'm interested in trying to develop more what happens for particle detectors, for a local detection of a particle. So I'm trying to develop local detectors using this framework. And we're also looking at using Gaussian quantum mechanics to sort of, for example, you can have a complete characterization of entanglement using this, using the methods of Gaussian quantum mechanics. Anyway, I think I'm stopped. I'm going to stop here.
Mm-hmm. One thing that does for you is it picks out a unique representation of economical computation relations from among the infinitely many that are related.
Yep.
In your approach, when you do your local quantization procedure, are you going to end up with different ways of doing the decomposition, which will correspond to different unitarily equivalent representations,
mm-hmm.
Which will then each be unitarily equivalent to the standard process representation.
Yep.
Or are you going to have another way of picking out what the physically meaningful one is?
Yeah. Just to toy around a bit with that question, yeah, so you can have put in something like this, and you look at local modes here, local modes there. Another similar local description would be to just put in another one here, right? So if I put in local modes here, that would be unitary and equivalent to this one without that guy, which is unitary and equivalent to the global one, right? So, but both of those would be sort of local descriptions here, right? It would just be that you have another imaginary localization point, right? So presumably, if you think like that, you can have unitary and equivalent representations like that. Also, the use of the word local here is a bit deceptive. There's nothing really local going on. It's really quasi-local, right? It's big regions, right? So anyway, that's just a comment. But I guess what you're looking at is if I impose that I should have modes and they all have Dirichlet boundary condition here, initially at t equals 0. And then you're asking, how many different ways can I do this local setup now?
Yeah,
right? Yeah, so I'm trying to think here. So you have this local mode, and it was this theta function here, right, minus r. And then you had to put your u dot here also, because it's only at a certain time you need to put in the initial conditions. And here we put it like this, right? So this was equal to some I omega t kt and some function chi t. There could be a different choice here, maybe. Maybe that could lead to unitary and equivalent ones. You can drop that also. we wanted to mimic as far as possible the sort of the local modes with Dirichlet boundary condition. It's not clear exactly if that's the best choice or you need. But I think though, over what I'm getting more and more convinced about is that I'm not sure this whole issue with Unitarian equivalent representations is a problem for predictions in physics. What's the first?
There's a thing here that you're thinking about. There's a fundamental tension between mathematics and physics.
Mm-hmm.
You see, as you say, but then, as you say, the first part of the book, never when you measure particle thinking in the picture, never going to be the first part. So that's the first one. So if you believe, then if you try to have this localization, then you come up with an infinite number of ways of passing the other space. So ultimately, the resolution, I think, is this. You know, this tension comes from the fact that you need the manifold.
I think one of the things is that maybe part of the answer is also how you model your detector, right? So maybe that you start saying this is sort of sensitive to this kind of modes, and that would suggest maybe the sinusoidal modes. But then again, if your detector is not sensitive to really high energetic modes and so on, would it? I'm not sure you would actually pick out a preferred representation out of all the. But this is definitely one thing. It would be interesting to try to model particle detectors and especially see if do they actually. Can you have sort of a realistic particle detector model where they would actually detect these kind of local modes now? That would be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is a
good, is a good approximation for the
mm-hmm.
up to.
Yes, yes, I think so. So it's a step, it's not a complete step, but it's sort of a first kind of step that you, and then you run into this Unitarian equivalent, which I find really fascinating. I mean, you ask a really sort of down-to-earth question, right? What does a particle detector detect? And you realize that there's all these issues with non-localizability. You try to do something which is local, and there you go. You get to, who ordered that, right?
A couple of comments. So one is, it seems like another important question besides can you detect a local particle. A more important question is, can a physically reasonable particle detector or instrument distinguish these two quantizations? You were making the point that, you know, the infinite number of particles may be undetectable by a physical detector.
Mm-hmm.
Let's forget about worrying about infinity and worry about finite things. My
mm-hmm.
guess would be that the two quantizations are observably different mm-hmm. with physical detectors, even in the presence of a cutoff. But that would be a really important thing to check. I
mm-hmm.
think it would just show explicitly that you get a different physical theory, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
Then if you do, which I think you will, then of course there's a question of which is the right one, if they're different.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like that goes back to what Laurent said, which is, you know, there's space-time has, you know, in the large of its Minkowski space, Poincaré symmetry, but really more important physically, in the small, it has Poincaré symmetry sort of locally. That's the equivalence principle.
Mm-hmm.
The way that, you know, quantum field theory and curved space-time has been understood is to regularize the stress tensor and other composite operators by the assumption that there's a universal form of the state at very short distances.
Mm-hmm.
Not infinitely short, but in a sort of limiting sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of picks out a special UV behavior
mm-hmm.
which, you know, your localization point violates. Because there's a, you know, everywhere except R, it satisfies it, but there's this peculiar point where surely it has different UV behavior. So I would wonder, is there a proof, or could you show that provided at every point you have the same UV behavior in a certain precisely defined sense, you know, then any two representations that share that are unitarily equivalent?
So this would sort of be some kind of generalization of using Poincaré invariants, right?
Yeah, but, it'd be a local form of universality of the symmetry structure. And it sort of seems it's tied to gravity in the sense that it's necessary just to even take the first step towards doing quantum field theory in curved space. You seem to need that to be true if you have any chance of preserving covariance. So anyway, I'm just not, it seems like these are really interesting questions.
Yep.
Maybe there's even already work done on that last question showing some answer. But,
there's very little sort of constructive work done here, I think. Most of the literature is within the algebraic quantum field theory literature, and then the very beautiful theorems and so on, and you can prove very powerful things. But what? Yes.
Talking about what?
Representation.
What?
They don't talk about representation.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
They talk about the algebraic.
Yeah.
Which is only physics.
Yeah, so here, I mean, we want to sort of add to that kind of, or to try to complement with very down-to-earth sort of just constructions, what happens now, right? It's also not clear to us exactly what goes wrong. I mean, we asked Hans Halvorsen, for example, about in his localization theorems. Well, we have local number operators. I mean, is it the unitary inequivalence that's the key issue now, or was it that you assumed? I mean, what kind of assumption made it impossible within these kind of theorems, right? So there's all kinds of things to think about, right?
So I guess what you're proposing here is to replace the notion of unitary equivalence with a physical notion of equivalence.
So,
he's proposing the same way. Who cares about the unitary equivalence? What we care about is, you know, the series are equivalent in terms of operational equivalence, physical measurement. And it might be that when you say they are locally equivalent at every point, then it corresponds to the unitary equivalence. Because then it would give you the way to say, well, just say they are equivalent up to a certain unit.
I'd be interested to look more, I mean, how one would phrase that mathematically also, this kind of limiting behavior, and also what, I mean, I'm not really clear how to think about that. And for example, would you sort of, I mean, so this was in one dimension, right? But in three dimensions, you may put a sphere like this, and you have sort of modes which are initially localized in here, and then modes which are localized outside, right? And then you can compare that to the ordinary sort of this the global modes you're using, right? And you're gonna find unitary equivalence. Basically, that happens because you impose Dirichlet boundary conditions, and you're always gonna have to use a lot of high frequencies to sort of to build such a mode from these local ones here, you're always going to use a lot of local frequencies to do it. Anyway, so you're going to probably find, I mean, you are going to find unitary equivalence. So, but already if you ask sort of local questions now here, right, I mean, aren't you putting in this ball here? Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, how would you phrase this mathematically of what is it that, what is it that shrinks and becomes smaller and smaller? What are you looking at exactly?
Neighborhood of a point. You know, something about the correlation function in the neighborhood of each point as you approach, it's all the points that are correlated approach that point.
So, and you'd require that thing to look exactly the same as in Minkowski spacetime or something?
Yeah,
like
have
that.
The same scaling behavior with the distance or something.
So there's a difficulty in doing that because the vacuum state is a global state, right? So even the local properties of the vacuum is not going to be. It depends if you have curvature around, right?
That's why you go to the limit when the curvature becomes irrelevant, and in fact, the distinction between different states even becomes irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
So all the states have a universal short distance behavior.
Sure, but the local state there, the quantum state restricted to this region here, might very well look like nothing like the Minkowski one. There's no reason, right? Because if you have curvature elsewhere, you're going to have some kind of equilibrium situation.
Yeah, but once you go to the ultraviolet limit, those effects would become irrelevant.
Okay.
I mean, at least that's the paradigm so mm-hmm. far for quantum field theory and curved space-time.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, nobody has any concrete alternative. Seems essential to the way it's done.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's another way to do it, though.
But in this paradigm, there's the idea that just with the smearing, there's the idea that you can smear operators and get operator product at the same time. But if you, let's say, restrict the type of operator you can use, you smear them with Gaussian, but Gaussian always has a size that is bigger than epsilon, then suddenly you're starting to have you can. So I mean, usually this characterization of vacuum arguments instead is really due to these assumptions about the high frequency local local properties of that.
Anyway, yeah. So
that when you trace the left part, you get a thermal state. So you were saying it's not thermal.
Yeah. So there are relationships.
What?
They're not the same loads.
Yeah. They're not exactly.
No, that, you were saying that the something. Yeah.
No. I mean there are relationships between the Rindler quantization. So one obvious difference is that we have a finite space, right? But if you would generalize this to have an infinite space, in both cases you would put in a point R here, which divides between left and right. In our case, we would put sinusoidal modes here, that extends all the way to infinity, and then the same thing here. The Rindler modes, though, there are the eigenstates or related to stationary modes with respect to the boost operators, and then they look like this. So they have a very very different behavior. So yes, you divide it into positive and negative killing frequency, and in the Rindler coordinates you have the same kind of positive and negative frequency story and so on, right? Exactly, yeah. And that has to do with that here, right? It's infinite redshift, right? But then, of course, you may... Yeah. And it's here, right, that you get this unitary inequivalence in the Rindler case, right? You have infinite frequencies here. So in our case, it's a bit different. You get it because, it's this phenomenon here. You have a Dirichlet boundary condition here. The Rindler modes, they don't even make sense in point zero. You have taken out the point zero because here they're fluctuating widely.
So the field here is the
No, the just the modes. So they do like this, all the modes here. So up here you're going to have really high frequency resolution. So you Yep. Thanks.